Hello and welcome to episode 447 of the Creating Crowbar Gaming Podcast, being recorded on the 27th of May, 2025. I'm Marsh Davis, and tonight I'm joined by an unstoppable killing machine, barely tethered to his own humanity, prepared to rip and tear through gaming discourse, yanking out its still pumping heart and popping it in his big, musculine hands. I talk, of course, of none other than Jamie Britton. Welcome, Jamie.
Hello!
If you were going to murder one game and tear out its heart in order to boost your base stats, what game would you commit a murder on?
I tell you what.
What attribute would it advance as well? That's the other question.
I tell you what, there is a... Because this is pertinent to the thing I'm probably going to talk about today, which is, like, we have a tablet for the child. It's half term at the moment. Parents will know it's half term at the moment, which can be a trying time where you try and fill your days with wholesome activities and then immediately abandon that and fill your day with non-wholesome activities, which, you know, keep them occupied while you can tidy the house in a constant, never-ending cycle and work out when you can start drinking in the day. But we have these, you can get the Amazon Fire tablets, right, which are like really like one of those things which are scarily cheap. They're like £50, and you can turn on, like, they work pretty well. I mean, the one we've got has been like chucked around and thrown off things many, many times. But you can put on a mode which is like Amazon Kids mode, which is might as well be called like just don't worry about it mode. And you just set them up with it, and they can download games and watch content to their heart's content, you know. And so you can sort of set up quite modular filter settings to see what they're playing. But like, actually, when you see what the games are, they are technically, in terms of content, sort of benign. Like, on paper, they're benign. But actually, in practice, they're horrifying. Because they're all kind of like, run a cake shop for pandas. You know, run a makeup salon for cats. You know,
diabolical.
They're diabolical in practice because they have these horrible bargain bin loops to them, where your kid does a thing, you know, you shave the cat, you put some new hair on it or whatever. It's all kind of creepy and faintly unholy. And they just play that for hours, you know, and you kind of you look at your kid's time, you're like, okay, they played cat hair salon for 6 hours. Clearly that's done some damage. That's done some irreparable damage to your child.
We won't also know for a good 50 years until the data's back.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But yeah, any of those games, I would be happy to tear the heart of them out and increase my stat for... I mean, my first instinct was guilt, which I can use as a sort of buff on speech tests, maybe against my own conscience.
I like that guilt is a base stat on the same parity with health.
Absolutely, yeah. Good. Like, it's in Dark Souls, you're leveling strength, dex, and guilt.
Beautiful. I think I'd go for Frog Detective, not because I dislike the game. I just want a really long tongue I can, you know, whip out and attach to things.
Good. I'm glad that's what you want to do with it. I was worried what you're going to say. With your horrible frog tongue.
Should we talk about some games that we've been playing?
Sure. Why not?
How about Doom, The Dark Ages?
Yes.
It's all right, isn't it? It's fine.
Yeah, it's okay.
Right, on to the next.
I mean, I do feel on this podcast, we do try and talk about games generally that we like, because God knows it's, you know, hard out there and, you know.
I try. I often fail, though, Jamie. Well, I think listeners will understand that that's true.
I think it's interesting because, you know, listening to the sort of discourse on this new Doom game, it's kind of had a, you know, relatively positive reception, and usually people talk admiringly about the series post 2016 having this ability to sort of iterate on itself. So 2016 was this kind of fun, you know, a sort of almost like a double A game with, you know, pretensions to something, you know, more. And I think that people really responded to that. It's a great game. It's one of those great games where if you start it, you'll finish it. You know, you can't sort of stop playing that one. It's got such a forward momentum to it, and it was such a lovely surprise. And then Doom Eternal, which I think is also really, really brilliant. I can understand, you know, people who don't quite click with that one. For me, it was worth it for the couple of, and it was only a couple of moments in that game where I did feel like a horrifying like dynamo of murder and kind of induced a like state of pure bloodlust in me, you know. There's a couple of moments where I realized I hadn't thought about anything apart from death and blood, you know, for like solid 20 minutes, and that was quite invigorating.
Was that also during a half-term break?
Absolutely, fucking, yeah. A day at the Hobble Down Heath in Felton will do that to you. So yeah, and with this one, I was interested in it because, you know, Doom Eternal was very fast and very furious, and names of other movies with cars in them. And I'd like the idea of slowing down and having a shield and bopping people with it. But I think the game, it feels like a lot's gone into it, but it still feels a little bit undercooked to me. That was kind of my main takeaway from what I've played. It's like, it's a solid enough experience, but I actually think it ends up being a little bit of a thin experience. I don't know how you found it, Marsh.
Well, I don't know. I was a bit trepidatious about this. I don't feel I can kind of authoritatively opine about the new Doom series, because it's sort of branched away from being a thing I understand well enough to kind of talk about. Like I really admire what the team have done in reinventing it as this sort of high skill ceiling combat sandbox. And I don't really care that it's, you know, whether or not it is a loyal expression of the original Doom, or I just think it's, you know, very evidently extremely well executed on, or, you know, the ways that it's traversal and target choices and weapon choices all interlock in interesting ways and create little novel challenges as you're kind of accessing some sort of reptilian flow state. But in a way, I feel like they're making sequels to Geometry Wars rather than Doom, and that's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But also, I just don't really want to play it. Like, it's not a reflection on that game. It's just, yeah, it's not what my gaming preferences are right now, for whatever reason.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? Because they're kind of tugging at one of the strings of Doom, which was, you know, inducing a state of bloodlust. I mean, I still play, you know, Doom 1 and 2 quite frequently, just because the more recent versions that they've done, like the remastered ones that they've put out, are very easy to like load up on Steam Deck and just blast away for a few minutes. And they've put all of the you know, subsequent expansions and fan mods and all that sort of stuff on there. That's mm-hmm. really easy, including like the stuff John Romero has made recently and things like that. But it is weird because that iteration of Doom, the original one, was this kind of mixture of, yeah, like bloodlust, but also like frustrating puzzle solving, you know, and kind right. of wandering around, which is like a necessary friction for you to kind of explore these spaces. And, you know, this game, you know, they've more or less done away with that. Not quite. There's still a little bit of pathfinding and key finding, at least in 2016, although it's kind of pretty obvious where you need to go at every single point. But I don't know, it's like, it does feel like an iteration away from, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see what the series would do with a reset, what they could lean into instead. Mm. I mean, they've done full horror before with Doom 3, and I played that relatively recently, but yeah, it's kind of turned into this whole thing now, and it's very confident in its own kind of world, and again, that's something I respect, that they've kind of built this whole mythology. But like as many people have said, I think in Doom 2016, the protagonist being impatient with the kind of weight of some of the way that games like to tell stories and things like that was really fun. They've mostly done away with that or found kind of other ways to be ironic. And actually, I do miss that side of it, actually, just a little bit.
Yeah, I actually think that some of that world building is just completely at odds with the nature of the game that they've made. It's very noticeably gray and brown, which is not bad in itself. But but put the way that works alongside the level and game design just sort of disguises, I think, a lot of the talent behind the art. Well, I know some amazing artistry in there. I'm a huge fan of Kenneth Scott, who is, you know, if you can think of a Gribbly in Doom, he's probably got his fingerprints on it.
Yeah.
But like, it's just in a literal sense difficult to see a lot of it because you know, you've got this reduced sort of like palette, and then the fact that you're always nearly moving at speed, and then there's, you know, by default there's this a big blue ring of whooshiness, like this screen effect over the screen as you're running. And it just literally obscures the environment. And you can turn that off in settings, but because of the way the nature of the game, you are inclined to tune out the background. And the you know, the game's palette makes it very easy to do so. And it just feels like, well, that's a bit of a shame, isn't it? Like, I mean, it just feels like the blue whoosh ring paradigm is sort of at odds with everything else they've made, to the extent that I don't think it would be a worse game, any less fun at all, if it was a purely grey boxed prototype.
No, and I think it ends up, I don't know, you know, I don't speak the language of graphics like you do, but with your whooshy blue rings, but like, it does end up being like a very, like, function, for whatever it actually is, it's a functionally narrow field of view because of what you're focusing on in the battle. So it's like you end up not looking at stuff, and you end up, you know, because you're, you know, basically playing a bullet hell game quite a lot of the time, you know, you're basically playing Ikaruga from a first person perspective, that, yeah, you do end up with a kind of strange myopia there where you're just sort of, you know, dashing around and shooting things and using your shield charge. And yeah, it's funny. I feel sometimes a little bit claustrophobic in that game, and not necessarily in a good way. And even though we've got these, like, these nice open worlds and these nice sections where you're stomping around as big Doom guy, it doesn't feel as wide and open and expressive as I think it could possibly.
I wasn't totally wowed by the big mech moments where you go around walloping demonic kaiju. I thought that felt very very staid and on rails in a way which is very reminiscent of like the big moments of gaming circa 2012, maybe.
Yeah, it's slightly like Bulletstorm's a great game, but like that was a while ago.
And actually,
I would say Bulletstorm has more of a sense of, you know, a kind of continuous adventure, you know, through a world, whereas this, you know, when you get into the big mech and start doing something, it's like it's very hard to like have a feeling of how one area leads on to another and kind of how the story is told, even the kind of story of you in this crazy incomprehensible world. You know, it kind of loses track of that a little bit, I think. You know, even Doom Eternal, where it had that, you know, your Fortress of Doom to return to, which was great because it gave you a little place to call your own and look at all your bobbleheads. But also it just meant you had, yeah, a continuity of like, all right, I'm being beamed up to this location now and all that kind of thing. Yeah, and I just think this game loses that a little bit. It's hard to know what, you know, the first-person shooter, I think, is in a little bit of a transitory stage at the moment, because there's obviously the kind of big behemoth franchises which kind of run everything, and then you hear about things being, you know, cancelled left, right and center, the sort of you know, rumors of Titanfall 3 and all that sort of stuff kind of going down the pan. And it's interesting because, you know, there is you know, a lot of time and effort is put into a relatively small amount of space, you know, with the Call of Duties and the kind of boomer shooter indie games are much more kind of where it lives. But I think a lot of people do feel quite a lot of kind of nostalgia to the kind of Titanfall 2s of this world. And I think it's kind of looked to Doom to really carry the torch of that. And I think that's a shame, actually, because there is a whole, I mean, and like with Machine Games kind of moving out of doing that kind of thing as well, and doing sort of what they've done, it, which is a really interesting iteration in a different direction. But yeah, I think, yeah, I sense that there will be a bit more of a, at some point there just has to be, because of the way the industry works in kind of waves and cycles, that we'll start seeing a bit more interesting work done in this space. I hope so anyway.
Yeah, but it's all right. It's fine.
Yeah, there is nothing wrong with it. So, I have to say, credit where credit's due. This kind of feeds into the next game we're going to talk about. Microsoft Game Pass is good value for money at the moment. Like, they are consistently bringing out new games on that, which are really good, like, value for money, you know, a solid release every couple of weeks or so, you know, with Clair Obscur and one of the games we're going to talk about, and Monster Train 2, which I've played a little bit of, and Doom, but just kind of the Oblivion remaster. It just feels like the kind of version of Games Pass that, you know, Phil Spencer was sort of promising a couple of years ago and sort of acting like actually existed is kind of, at least at this moment in time, is kind of there. It's kind of extant. And I think, you know, I think a couple of years ago we were sort of slagging off Xbox and kind of the slightly missed opportunities of Game Pass on here. And I've been thinking recently, actually, it's kind of been a pleasure to load up Game Pass and go like, ooh, there's a new thing here. Excellent.
What are we going to talk about next, Jamie?
A game I haven't played.
Oh, okay. That's the game. Okay.
that's the Game Pass game, South of Midnight.
South of Midnight. It's good. I enjoyed it.
Great.
Well, I enjoyed it much more as a narrative experience than I did as a game. It's but it's testament to how much I enjoyed the narrative side of it that I actually pushed through and played the whole thing, even though I thought actually playing it was sometimes quite a chore. But it's like a Southern Gothic adventure, which is just very underrepresented in gaming generally. And you play this young track athlete called Hazel, who is attempting to locate and rescue her mother, who has been separated from her by a catastrophic flood in one of the southern states of America. And she finds herself swept away, see what I did there, into a world of folklore and magic, which in the broad strokes of it isn't that wildly striking. But what is just really arresting about it is the language of it, which is just... it's just so confidently and like evocatively rooted in a particular place and culture. And the voice acting is superb. There's a giant fish in the game who appears to be made out of quilts, which is, he has like one of my favorite vocal performances in this game and probably many others, but it's the writing of the dialogue just has this great ear for dialect and cadence and idiom. And, I don't know. It was just really refreshing when so much of media in general is written for this sort of like median audience. It's just really nice to hear something which is uniquely placeable, and it invites you to that place. You know, it's not at all alienating in the way that I imagine execs fear it is. It's intriguing. It's enticing.
Is the frog? Did you say it's a frog that's got it?
A fish.
A fish. Is that fish? Is that the fish that's called Roo? Is that right?
No, I can't remember what the fish is called. I think Roo. I think Roo is somebody else in the game.
Yes, I'm just looking at the cast on IMDb, and Roo, whoever that is voiced by Ahmed Best, who I believe is Jar Jar Binks.
No way.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah,
he's not putting in quite the same performance in this.
No, okay,
you'll be good. Pleased to know.
less racially troublesome, maybe.
Well, I mean, it's a you know, a very racially pertinent game. There's, you know, I mean, I, for one thing, it has a black protagonist, which is rare in itself. Mm. But it also it's directly speaking to the black experience in the South without any kind of apology or caveat, which obviously neither of those are necessary. But that makes it, I think, probably unique. Outside of indie games, I can't think of another game of this size and prominence which has addressed the black experience in the South quite as directly. And while it isn't like It's not about slavery. It does address it and its legacy in quite a deep way. And it sort of, it circles around racism in this really interesting way, because it doesn't, a lot of it is about what is unsaid, but it doesn't feel dishonest in kind of avoiding that stuff. It's, there is like a richness to what is unsaid, which is deeply poisonous.
Yes, absolutely.
But very interesting. Like Hazel has this rich white grandmother, and their exchanges are just full of this, like, just layers and layers of condescension and resentment and classism and racism, but also, like, this is interweaved with, like, a very personal family drama as well, and that makes it feel very authentically complex in a way which, it, you know, it would be very easy to come at these topics in a facile way or in a didactic way, and it never feels like that. It just feels like all of these things are part of the richness of this world, which they are. And you know, even though that Hazel's grandmother is this absolute piece of work, she has a real depth to her as well. And you know, there's this, you know, a bitterness to her life informed by loss and all these other things that have made her the way she is. And it's, and all of that is set into this magic realist fable, you know, in which Hazel encounters magical creatures that have become the way they are as a result of some unaddressed wrong in history, like some tragedy that has lingered unresolved and festered, and as a result of it, it's sort of torn reality in some way. And so Hazel sets about sewing reality back together, partly magically, but also partly just by, like, unpicking and understanding these stories in a really empathetic way. And all of that's tied into a larger Cajun mythology of, like, malevolent spirits that feed on nightmares and emotions, and it's just really rich stuff, and it's all the richer for the fact that it's, to me personally, very unfamiliar.
It sounds fascinating, and it's so, you know, the whole kind of Southern Gothic aesthetic, it's so easy for it to be tedious. You know, I know I share with you a kind of a slight disdain for the lazy version of this, you know, the kind of the Netflix version of this, and it's kind of, it's nice to hear that they've gone into it with, like, clearly a story to tell and confidence about it, and that ability is always a good sign of something when you can see something suffused with the, you know, the political backdrop of the time without feeling like they have to, you know, just talk exclusively about that. You know, it's how you tell these stories with a sense of realism and a sense of character and uniqueness, and not just turn it into, you know, Netflix slop.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't feel at all sloppy. It doesn't feel tokenistic in any way. It just feels, deeply truthful in a way which, you know, it feels like somebody really wanted to write this, which is kind of rare in games. Like, yeah. you can see often writers are coloring in the shapes that have been left for them by game designers and execs, and sometimes they do better jobs, sometimes they do worse jobs, but often the shape of the thing that they're writing has been predetermined by other people. But it feels like the writers in this had a real stake in the world, and that's evident. I think there's a kind of sense of enthusiasm to it, which is nice.
Do you do some fighting and jumping in this game?
Yeah. Yes, regrettably. Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, all of this is like, all that storytelling, which is superb, is paired with a slightly creaking platformer, which wouldn't feel amiss in its verbs from, like, the era of the first Uncharted, maybe, or, you know, there's just, I mean, it's not awful. I like the affordances for like moving through that environment gradually expand as you get through the game, and it does become kind of more freeing, but it's a very restricted environment that you're moving through, and it just feels a little old hat. And the combat in the game, in a weird way, it feels comparable to Doom. not in terms of the...
No ripping and tearing, I think.
Well, there is a little bit of ripping and tearing, but it's more that you feel in Doom that you're often walking from one enclosed combat arena to another.
Yeah, well, that's just what the world's like. I mean, I don't know if you've ever walked around outside Marsh, but you know, you walk.
I try not to.
I come into my house and it's a big round room with pillars.
Right. Yeah. Well, even in Doom, it's more freeform than here, where it is like explicitly and mechanically, like each combat is enclosed in a little bubble, like a literal bubble. I can guess why they've done that. That there's probably good budget and scope reasons for not having to worry about how AI pathfinds around a larger environment or collides with it. But it just ends up being impossible not for that to feel enormously repetitive and almost completely divorced from the rest of the other game's content and themes. It's just you're doing all this interesting stuff and it's like, oh god, I gotta go into another fight bubble. It's really wearisome. And the boss battles, which differentiate from that, are also just not terribly enjoyable. But it looks fucking amazing. Like, it's got this stop motion effect, and the characters sort of look like they might have been sculpted in something other than a digital environment. That's the feel that they're going for. But also, just this the landscape in the game is beautiful. It's very kind of overgrown, swampy landscape, which has been, you know, double swamp by the flood, which is very slowly receding. Monster swamp. And does foliage really well. I know how much you love foliage.
I do love foliage.
You know, a dense bank of varied trees, varied cultivars. Oh, fringing a gully, you say? Oh, yes. Games have rarely done it better.
You know how foliage artists work is that they build, I mean, you probably know this is new information to me when a colleague telling me about this, but they build like one like Socratic ideal of a bush and then they have that bush and then they like place it into the world and then they kind of randomize or systemize the ability to sort of detract from that bush. So you never see the perfect version. You just see like slightly shitty copies of it, and that is how you create a realistic sense of foliage and plant life in your game.
Right? Yeah, it's all about the degenerate bush.
it's the best Snoop Dogg album. That one,
Snoop Dogg's Degenerate Bush. Yeah. Talking of Snoop. Or rather, talking of the soundtrack, this game has a really remarkable bluesy soundtrack. Lots of finger-picked guitar.
Nice.
It's really shockingly good. Apart from the lyrics, so I've been like absolutely pouring sugar on the writing of this game. But it's really strange because there's this enormous subtlety in getting that dialogue to have that authentic patter to it and have all that kind of the layers of meaning and stuff. And there's like a larger, you know, kind of wonderment and mystery to the magical events. But then the soundtrack's lyrics are like, ooh, ooh, he's been turned into a tree. He wishes he was free. It's a tragedy. And you're like, oh, okay. Maybe I'll just turn the music slider down for a second in the settings.
Yeah. Oh, well, it sounds excellent, and I do wish to play such a game. I hopefully will. I don't know why I'm talking like this.
Maybe. What have you been playing? So, perhaps with a child?
Yes. So it is half term, as I mentioned, and aside from the massive set of wholesome activities I've been doing with my children, I've been trying to get them to play video games because being a parent is often quite boring and video games keep me stimulated. And it's funny because as earlier discussions, it's like the games that kids will naturally gravitate towards are often the ones with the kind of path of least resistance, which is why those cursed Amazon tablet games are so, you know, kind of easy to play and where they'll go to, because actually games are quite difficult usually. So there are plenty of kind of Peppa Pig games, Bluey games, things like that, which will keep their attention for a little bit, especially the little one. She's three and she's happy to kind of poodle away on pretty much anything. they do this good thing on PlayStation now where you can have your controller and then you can assign another controller as the kind of support controller, meaning that if your kid's playing, you know, whatever, and is stuck, you can just pick up your controller and use yours to kind of and make them think that they're doing it themselves, which is lying and doesn't, you know, but I don't need my child to think she's, you know, I don't mind lying to my child about her ability to play Astrobot. It's fine. The 8-year old, my 8-year old, she's a bit neurodiverse, and things like controlling a game don't necessarily come naturally to her or easy to her. And again, it's that same problem of like that thing that's been said many times before of like, right, you control your character with the left stick and you control the camera with the right stick. Unless you've been playing games for years, it just doesn't make sense. You're like, it takes a long time for her to internalize. So I've been trying to play a few games with her. We started off with Infinity Nikki, which a friend of mine recommended and said, oh, he's been playing with his daughter. And Infinity Nikki is a gacha game where you play as a princess lady in a really like stunningly realized, like open world, Breath of the Wild style, where your kind of magical powers and your destiny are tied up in the clothes you're wearing. And obviously it has gacha mechanics where you know, rolling for particular outfits and stuff like that. Really exquisitely drawn, like clearly like just billions and billions of man hours have gone into this game. We played it for a little while before I had a kind of moment of like, what the fuck am I exposing my daughter to? This is like so bad and wrong. Like, you know, I'm literally, you've got this kind of, you know, incredibly attractive, in a very specifically conventional way, you know, protagonist who you're encouraged to kind of dress up, and her powers are basically related by how snappily she dresses. And I just thought, actually, no, there is nothing about this that I can possibly tolerate infecting her mind with. So we moved on to It Takes Two, the kind of two-player kind of co-op game, which is like right at the top of her ability, really. It took a little bit of... So if you don't know, It Takes Two is a game where you play as a... About to divorce mother and father who are transformed into kind of what even are they transformed into? Little like ragdoll figures who are miniaturized, and they have to kind of work together to get out of their basement. And the whole thing's a metaphor for divorce or whatever. You know, it's a lovely game to play. My daughter liked it because the kind of...
Did it not raise any worrying questions for her parents' relationship as she's playing it?
I mean, if she has those worries, I don't think it's the video game that's going to raise. We're quite capable of doing that ourselves.
It's the fist fights, is it? They gave it away.
Yeah, Victorian. But yeah, that game, so you have to... You know, work together, and the screen is split, and you're often, yeah, the game is about collaboration, so you have to do it. She does her best with it. Often things take quite a lot of coordination. You know, you have to do a thing where one person will, you know, pull a lever in the right space, and then allow another character to kind of be fired off somewhere and then do another thing. And it's quite clever how it like sequences those things. So you'll do something that's quite simple, and it'll swap between the characters in terms of what they have to do. Playing through the first sort of area of that up to the first boss, which is a really angry vacuum cleaner, I have to say was a really, really wonderful bonding experience between us, because we were basically just shouting at each other throughout, but in a kind of good-natured way. And there was quite a lot of challenge there. There was no way to obviate that challenge. You had to do it. And fighting that final boss, like, the game has no fail states until you get to the boss fight. Like, if you fall down a ledge, it'll just start you back up again. But with the boss battles, I assume, at least we only played the first one, you know, if you both get kind of downed by the boss, then you die. And we fought that fucking thing for, it was probably only 25 minutes, but it felt like a very long time. Maybe it was more, maybe it was an hour. And it was right at the absolute extent of our abilities to work together. And actually beating that boss and kind of getting past that moment, we were probably done with the game from then on. But it was really nice to kind of, a really nice bonding experience. I hadn't yet played any kind of game with a narrative with her. And I think it's a really good one to have on the back burner to maybe go back to when she's a little bit more dexterous with the gamepad, because, you know, and I know those, that company have a, you know, this game out recently, Split Fiction, which a lot of people have been saying good things about. And it is true that, like, the way that it takes two, at least, prompts you to work together is very, very clever and very, very shrewd, and actually is a kind of constructive form of cooperative play, which I hadn't really encountered before, because it's sort of, the necessity of it is tied into the narrative stakes, but also into the level design itself. Like, it will set you an objective and expect you to get to it, and you know, there are wonderful moments where, you know, even for my 8-year-old, where she'll go scurrying off to try something out before we've even communicated about it, you know, in the room. So that was really good fun. So I want to go back to that one. The other games we've been playing are Nidhogg.
So, oh, wow, yes.
So Nidhogg...
Slightly less cooperative in its nature.
Yes, absolutely. So Nidhogg, which I just checked and was first discussed on episode 25 of Creating Crowbar.
Wow. So
I don't think it's... I think it's okay to talk about it again 10 years later. But so Nidhogg is a fencing game where you play as two little stick figures. It was really fun to boot up with my daughter, because I'd never played it before and I just thought it would be fun to try. So we didn't actually know what the rules were. And puzzling that out was actually quite fun in of itself, right? So with Nidhogg, basically when you kill the other player with your sword, you then have to kind of run to the other end of the level through a few screens, and then get eaten by a worm, which she thought was hilarious and is quite funny. And it took us a while to work that out. And it has been quite interesting watching her play that game, because it's a game where you're basically wildly stabbing at each other with swords. But there is obviously some skill in it, but you can play it for quite a long time without any skill. And it's been really satisfying to see how that game rewards like skill with moments of stupidity. And it's just a really interesting transaction that goes on. So like watching her work out that you can throw your sword, you know, it was really fun because she was doing that constantly. And then, of course, I worked out how to block it. And then watching her work out how she could throw the sword and then run towards me, like roll under me and then punch me in the back of the head, all that sort of stuff. And she doesn't mind losing to me, which means I can still have fun like trying to beat her because it's so stupid. And you get eaten by a worm at the end anyway. And it's got like gore as well, but it's all just the color that your character is, which kind of ends up soaking the level. So it's just all very pleasantly slapstick. She loves the music as well, because the music's got all this kind of bizarre, mad, sort of echoey, distorted sound to it, which is just really unusual and strange. So that's what, that was a hit, and she's asked to play that a whole bunch of times. So yeah, Nidhogg. weirdly good game for kids. There's something very funny about it, just generally. Like even the way the characters run is just hilarious, and your kind of these sprints you make to get to the ends of levels, really hilarious. So that's been fun playing that with her. And then the last game I'll talk about playing with my kids is actually something I've been playing with an emulator, which I guess you can arrest me for, but is Kirby's Air Ride. So they recently announced a remake of this when they were announcing the Switch launch games. And I remember playing it years ago and not really understanding it, but I've been playing it on emulator with both kids, because Kirby's Air Ride is a game for the GameCube from 2000 and whenever, where there's no accelerate. It's a racing game and there's no accelerate. You just zoom around your track on your little star, and you press X to kind of go around corners. Yeah. You can kind of hold down and then you release and you fly off. And then you've also got these abilities where you can suck up the enemies that you encounter in the level and use them against each other. And I play that with both kids, so with the 8-year-old and the 3-year-old on a split screen, using my Steam Deck as an emulator. And it's such a wonderful game. It's brilliant. First of all, you can play it with kids because Kirby zooms along perfectly happily without you doing anything at all. The levels are beautiful. You've got all these incredible kind of moments where you sort of, you know, there's one that starts off above the ocean and then dips down underneath it, and you get this kind of amazing vista of this underwater, this underwater city and these kind of mad techno landscapes and things like that. There's so much artistry and beauty in that game, and one of those great kind of sort of Nintendo soundtracks with lots of kind of bombastic horns and things like that. And it's just a really, it's a really stimulating, really kind of unthreatening world to play. And you, neither of them care if they lose or win, really, because it's so much kind of fun to have the kind of experience of it.
That sounds amazing. It sounds like you've really gauged the right level as well and found something which is quite a thin strata of experiences that are kind of uniquely joyful. I mean, being, as you just said, like unthreatening and what was the other word you used? I don't know. Whatever you were saying.
Whatever I said. Yeah, yeah. Time's fleeting. Move on. Yeah, it's funny because, like, even though, like, Nidhogg is violent, it's violent in such a stupid way that I'm not worried about my 8-year-old. I mean, I was playing fucking cannon fodder and worse when I was her age.
Sure, yeah.
Which are, you know, I guess probably quite similar, actually. You know, I'm certainly not going to be firing up Doom.
No.
I've been playing the Resident Evil 4 remake recently, and I have to turn that off so quickly if they walk into the room, because the shotgun in that game just tears people limb from limb. It's so violent and gory. But yeah, like, it going back into the kind of retro games, like also playing a bit of like something like Beautiful Joe as well, where it's just like it's fizzy and stimulating and but also sort of safe as well, and that's kind of a nice little place to be, I think. Yeah, and Kirby's Air Ride is, like, I'm really, really excited for the remake, because I think when the original came out, it got kind of, just from, like, reading up on it a little bit, it got, like, I think Edge gave it, like, a brutal score of 4 or something, you know? which is, you know, hardcore for them for a Nintendo first-party game. So I think it was slightly got maligned at the time, but it's actually clearly something of a lost classic. One thing that's quite funny about it is it has rubber banding, so if one person falls behind, they get a speed boost, which you can set in the options. But because my kids will often fall quite far behind because they'll end up like going the wrong way or something, the rubber banding is such that, like, if I've got really far ahead and they're miles behind, the speed at which their characters will end up going is just, like, mind-buggeringly fast. It would just shoot them off to kind of catch up, and that's quite fun to watch them going, I don't know what's going on, so sort of zooming around these crazy levels. So yeah, one of the levels, you get loaded into a cannon and fired into another country halfway through the track. It's pretty great. So yeah, various games with my children to play.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, it's nice.
It's nice to introduce them to the cosmic horror, which is Kirby at a young age as well. It's good for them to, you know, get that trauma out of the way.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's so many, like, it's one of those games where it's all controlled with two buttons, so it's just the left stick and the X button. As you go around corners, and the same one to suck up abilities, and then you can flick your stick to do a little spin attack on the other enemies. But, like, the power-ups, there's so many of them, and they also all interact with each other, and they also have, like, counters. There's that kind of weird thing. Again, it's kind of quite Kirby-like, I think, to have, like, quite a lot of weird depth. Because I think that game's director is the Smash Brothers guy, which, again, has a similar kind of level of depth and interaction and all that kind of... The games seem quite simple, but then they're actually really overstuffed. And actually, to a kid who's just not really, you know, doesn't care about the story behind it or how you got there or, you know, what lineage the game exists in, like, the fact that, like, you can turn Kirby into a bird, and which will give him a speed boost, but if you hammer on the X button while he's doing it, he'll flap his wings and you'll go even faster and all that sort of stuff is, like, just... really fun for a kid, I think, without them having to necessarily understand the mechanics behind it.
Sounds good. Do you have games lined up for them next?
I play a little bit of Rhythm Heaven with them, again, which they announced a new version of coming out for Switch 2 next year, which I'm super excited about because the Rhythm Heaven games are amazing. They're the same people who make the, again, this is like back page podcast material. I'm so underqualified to talk about this stuff, but the Rhythm Heaven people are the people who make the WarioWare games. So they're like mini game geniuses. And then the Rhythm Heaven games are, yeah, musical versions of it. I'm sure I've spoken about them before because they're so like wonderfully joyous. The one I emulate is the one from the Wii, which I think is called Rhythm Heaven Fever, which is just got loads and loads of mini games in it. And there's one which me and my daughters are obsessed with, which is called, I believe it's called Ringside Interview. I might send you the YouTube link to put it in the show notes because it is just like Bottle Joy, which has a woman interviewing a wrestler, and she says to him, "Wubba dubba dub, is that true?" She says to him, and then you have to press X to make him go, "Mm." And then she says it again, "Wubba dubba dub, is that true?" "Mm." This, we actually do this on car rides to half the time because she also goes, "Wow, you go, big guy." And then when she says that, you press X twice and he does that kind of pose. And then a photographer shouts from off, "Pose for the fans." And on that one, you press X and B, and he goes, "Oh," like this. It's just, and you can, it mixes it up so you don't know which one's kind of wubba dubba dubba, is that true? Wow, you go, big guy. Pose for the fans. Oh. And yeah, we just sort of play that as a game with each other and to kind of call and response. So, and that's really good. But yeah, the new Rhythm Heaven game, I'm really looking forward to playing with my kids because I think, again, it's like all played with one button. You have to just hit the beat. And they mix it up to have games which are like, you know, very simple, and they get more complex as they go on, you know. But as you know, one of the famous ones is a monkey that squeaks and throws a golf ball, and you hit the golf ball, and there's a big mandrill monkey standing there that throws a baseball at you, and you have to hit that on the offbeat as well. Things like that. It's just like really good and really, really kid friendly. Yeah.
Are there any games that you're sitting on that you can't wait for them to be just, you know, old enough to play? Not in terms of maturity, just like in terms of dexterousness or willingness to embrace challenge.
I mean, yeah, I would love to get a three-person Spelunky squad going with my two girls. I do think it might be a bit beyond, I mean, it's beyond me, so it's definitely going to be beyond them to play that. You know, I love the thought of that. There's a person I know at work who's been playing it with his kids, but I think his kids are better at video games than me. Like so, and my children. So there's that. I know that once my eldest has, like, again, she's just a little ways off kind of getting this sort of skill level up to be able to like play through one of the 3D Mario games, you know, because what I'd really like her to have, I think, and I think the thing that she'd really enjoy is that sense of discovering something for yourself, you know. Rather than having dad there going like, "Oh, now look behind the waterfall, you know, now you now pet the dog, whatever." Mm. Like, I think games are so good at hiding secrets and delightful things in them that I would love to have for her to have, you know, those kind of experiences rather than like, yeah, clip this badger's toenails on the tablet game. Right. Which I've seen her do. Yeah. And then PT, once she reaches her ninth, I'm going to sit in a room and I'm going to say, "Right, you're going to have to finish PT. You're not leaving this room until it's done." And then I'll be arrested.
Yeah. Do you want to answer some questions or a question from questions?
Let's answer a question from questions.
Noel writes, "Inspired by Tom and Jamie's discussion of adventure games, I was curious what, if any, favorite parser games the podcast hosts have. By this, I mean ones where you have to type in words, you get words back. Personal modern favorites of mine are Counterfeit Monkey, a brilliant wordplay game by Emily Short, where the first item you get is a tea remover that can turn a tote into a toe. And Hadean Lands, an alchemy game by Andrew Plotkin on a mysterious spaceship." So I asked a follow-up question just to, because I wasn't familiar with the term parser games, and it seems that this is a very common term and I'm an idiot, but it means like a subset of text adventure games where you're typing in words rather than selecting from a list of verbs or options.
I haven't played many of these. I've played, you know, my fair few text adventures, and I've spoken about them before on the pod. But yeah, these kind of specifically parser games, not too familiar with. I will say, as a kind of stupid answer, is that the video game Enter the Matrix, which was the game that takes place whilst the Matrix Revolutions, I think, is happening. There's a bit in that movie where, what's the actor's name? She's Will Smith's wife. Chris Rock didn't keep his name out of her mouth.
Her. Is it Jaden or is that some
relative? That's his son.
Okay. Oh no.
She's not the one who whipped her hair back and forth. In fact, she had the opposite problem, if you remember. What's her name? I can even remember her character in The Matrix. She's called Niobe, right?
Will Smith's wife, Jada.
Keep her name out of your mouth.
Pinkett. Yeah, Smith. Will Smith emerges from beneath her, my death to wallop me.
Yeah, Jada Pinkett Smith. There's a bit in one of the Matrix movies where she's like, okay, I'm in. And what's happened there is the video game that was released around about the same time, the player has defeated the enemies in that. So, I love that game. It's really stupid. It's really bad. But it's kind of fun. It's got slow motion killing in it, which is always good. But on the disc, it came with, on PlayStation, it came with like a hacking mini game where it gave you a command prompt with all like Matrix colors on it. And you had to like hack into this system, you know, by like typing the word help. And then looking down the list of commands there and finding the relevant functions. And it was silly, but it was perfectly pitched for my, like, I don't know, I guess 15-year-old brain to kind of sit there and puzzle out with a PlayStation controller in my hand. And eventually you, like, unlocked a message from Morpheus, which actually, you know, Lawrence Fishburne voiced. And it was just a really nice thing for them to include because it just gave you a little campaign. It's funny because years later when I played the game that Chris Thurston wrote, what's it called, that one? The hacking one he did.
Hackmund.
Yeah, Hackmund. Like playing that years later, and that is exactly the same gameplay, but like, you know, clearly written by people who are, you know, experts in their field rather than like, presumably one of the designers of that game in an afternoon writing a little text tree thing. But yeah, that was a favourite of mine because it's just a little surprise that they kind of included on the disc and kind of was fun to sort of fiddle around with.
Yeah, I can't think of that many parser games as differentiated from other kind of text adventure games that I've played. Certainly not recently. I suppose Type Help counts. Beyond that, I think, I don't know if maybe the success of Inkle and its product Ink means that a lot of text adventures and Twine and things have meant that text adventures have sort of become dominated by choice-based text adventures rather than parser-based text adventures.
Yeah,
that's complete supposition, probably bullshit.
we'll
never know.
I mean, Emily Short is one of those people who, you know, kind of everything she sort of ever touched is worth investigating. So I'm going to look up that one that I'll mention and maybe it'll make an appearance on a future pod. It's funny because it's interesting to know, you know, what a parser game gives you, really. I think information games are quite well suited to them. I think, you know, Sam Barlow games are well suited to them, even though they're not technically parser games. But like the stuff that Inkle do, like I recently played through the first three Sorcery games, which I really recommend, by the way, if anyone listening hasn't played them, they're wonderful. And even though they're not parser games, they basically functionally exist as them. Like the amount of choice you're given in those games is really kind of exceptional, and the amount of command you have over your story and your character and your place in this world, it reminds me of the feeling of a kind of a text adventure, but done with, you know, a supreme amount of confidence and authorial voice behind it and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, I do feel like, you know, that provides something that, you know, perhaps that genre would have done in the past, maybe. Yeah. That sense of response. Like, it's like a level of narrative cradling of the player that, like, you know, ChatGPT couldn't get close to because it's catered and it's based on original thoughts rather than stolen from them, I guess.
Is that the end of the podcast, Jamie? Is that all we can manage? Is that all we can tolerate?
Yeah, it is.
Excellent. Well, if you'd like to send us a question, you can do so at questions@CreightonCrowbar. You can join our Discord community, the link for which is on our website, CreightonCrowbar.com. They're lovely. There's a sub-Discord channel, I don't know what it's called, for questions. You can put questions in there. You can also watch these podcasts as videos on YouTube, where you can find other nonsense by us. The address for that is youtube.com/CreightonCrowbar. And you can also back us on Patreon. The address for which is patreon.com/CreightonCrowbar. That's it. I've been Marsh Davis.
And I've been Jamie Britton.
Farewell.
Bye. Wubba dubba dub, is that true? Mm. Wubba dubba dub, is that true?
Mm. Wow, you go, big guy.
Pose for the fans. Oh.